From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb, filling in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Now, it may seem a little early to be talking about November's midterm elections, but across the country, Democratic challengers for seats in the House of Representatives and the Senate are preparing their campaigns, plotting strategies, honing their messages. The goal, to reclaim majorities in both houses of Congress. And let's not kid ourselves, the men, and possibly one woman, who are thinking about running for president in 2004 are doing the same. The question is, what message will help the party's candidates sustain the steady gains they've made in recent years? The main source of ideas for the party, going back to the mid-80s, has been the Democratic Leadership Council, the group that invented the concept of the New Democrat, the business-friendly wing of the party, the triangulators who said build prosperity first, then use government to deal with social problems. But the nation is in flux. Business-friendly in a time of corporate scandal, with people's pensions being wiped out, may not be a message that works. The party's traditionalists and plenty of ordinary voters want to see a return to tighter regulation of business practice. We're talking this hour about the Democrats' prospects in the midterm elections. Does the economic strategy that got Bill Clinton elected twice still work? Is it time for a new brand of populism? Is the Democratic Party in a position to return to dominance? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now is Reed Teixeira, senior fellow at the Century Foundation and author of the forthcoming book, The Emerging Democratic Majority. Good evening, Reed.
Good evening. Let me point out just initially that that book is co-authored with John Judas. I don't want to take all the credit.
Okay.
He deserves most of the credit.
Okay. John Judas deserves most of the credit, but the coming Democratic dominance, the emerging Democratic majority, echoes of Kevin Phillips' book, famous, a White House paper in 1968 in the Nixon White House, how the Republicans could dominate for decades by creating a new coalition. You deliberately echo that.
Exactly. Yes. No, it's our contention that if you look carefully at the election returns and the demographic trends over the 80s and 90s and the economic transformation the U.S. is going through, on net, these changes tend to favor the Democrats. And on net, that should lead to a fairly stable Democratic majority sometime in the first decade of this century.
Okay, we're going to get to that fairly quickly, but I just wanted to just talk a little bit about the Democratic Leadership Council summer convention, which took place this week. And I suppose the press reported it mostly as an early beauty contest for prospective Democratic contenders for the presidential nomination. But one of the interesting things, of course, is that the country itself at this moment is in a remarkable state of flux, and it's not entirely clear that the kind of new democratic economic policies would still hold the same electoral appeal in this emerging democratic majority that you speak of.
Well, first of all, we should be clear, I think, in what we mean by new democratic economic policies. If you look at the policies of Bill Clinton, who is the guy actually running the country, and the Democrats in general in the 90s, I don't think you could really say that the kinds of regulations that are currently being proposed are inconsistent with that kind of democratic economics. If you look at Bill Clinton's 92 presidential campaign, he very much ran as a sort of populist. Even if you look at the 96 campaign, it's clear not only did he talk about building a bridge to the 21st century, and not only did he talk about, at times, about being friendly to business, but he also talked about defending important social programs that go back to the New Deal, and he talked about trying to help out those who were, hardworking families and this kinds of thing. If you look at the reality of new democratic economic policies and also political policies as they played out in the real world, not in the position papers of the DLC, I think there's always been a mix of a sort of populism that really is a tradition in the Democratic Party and, sort of these more identifiably new democratic themes about the new economy, about not being anti-business, about opportunity instead of handouts, this sort of thing. It's always been a mix. And I think in some ways this debate that took place or tried to take place, I'm not sure how far it will go, in New York was really kind of missed the point, I think, of where the party has gone in the last 10 years or so.
Where has the party gone?
Well, I think the party has moved to the center, as certainly New Democrats would say. But the center that it's moved to is what we call in this book that has been mentioned, the progressive center. And the progressive center, I think, is composed of, you know, we could get into the demographics of the groups it composes, but I think it's added the attitude of this emerging coalition toward the market is one that is simultaneously critical and supportive. It's critical in the sense that it sees that the market itself is not going to be able to deliver, and business left to its own devices will not deliver the kind of society or the kind of prosperity people need. Nevertheless, even though it needs to be regulated and guided and so on, it has to be done in a moderate and responsible way. And, you know, business obviously can't be made to feel that it's in an unfriendly environment. So it goes both ways. I mean, business, I mean, one of the big themes of the DLC always has been no special interest. Everybody has a responsibility to the community, to the nation as a whole. I mean, I think one thing that would be consistent with that at the present time is to say that to business right now. You have a responsibility to the community and to the society as a whole, and you have to follow the rules just like everybody else. So it's a little odd, isn't it, I think, that in this is sort of an opportunity to bring a special interest to heel, and yet they seem to be mostly talking about the alleged dangers of creating an anti-business climate in the United States, which personally I don't think is likely.
Yeah, let's leave them aside then. Let's cast the DLC aside for a second and look at the demographic factors that go into your thesis that there is another period of Democratic dominance. And do you mean by that both regaining the White House and Congress, or will you cede the White House until 2008 and just say Congress, governorships, and important local municipalities?
No, I certainly wouldn't cede the White House in 2004. I think Bush is actually quite vulnerable, as we're now starting to see. What we are saying in the book is not that the Democrats will necessarily win in a given election, but the political terrain is shifting in such a way that going into most elections, they will have a built-in advantage, which should allow them to win more often than not. And that should translate into winning the presidency more often than not, controlling Congress most of the time. And I think that's the kind of era we're moving into, whether it will arrive in full force in 2004 or not until 2006 or 2008 is hard to say. But I think the Republicans are pretty nervous at this point. So you may think, and others may think out there, that 2004 is a lock for Bush, but I don't think they believe it.
Okay. We've just been joined on the line by Senator John Corzine, Democrat of New Jersey. Good evening, Senator.
Good evening. Good to be here.
Let me ask you, sir, we're talking very much about strategies, I think, for the upcoming election. Now, you don't have to worry about that, but except in the most intellectual kind of way. I mean, you're not up for re-election.
No.
But I'm wondering, there was a very interesting poll that came out today. It was done for NPR, Stan Greenberg, who's a Democratic pollster, and Republican Bill McIntyre, noting that at this particular instant, the currents are shifting. And I'm just wondering if you're picking up any of that yourself from hearing from your constituents, Senator Corzine, about what it is that's going to concern them in November when they go to vote for their local representative in Congress.
Well, I think there is a shift that really began with 9/11 and the events following that, and with regard to picked up speed, with regard to corporate responsibility and accountability for some of the abuses that we've seen, that there is a real role for government in our community life, that we need checks and balances to protect us against those that would attack us from without, and that we need to make sure that the excesses that build up in our economy and in our society have governmental checks and balances to make sure that they don't undermine people's security. And that can be financial security, retirement security, health security, environmental security. You apply that in a lot of ways. And I just think that people are beginning to sense that there is a role for government to play in society. It doesn't have to be an intrusive one, but it needs to be one that protects people from some of the excesses that build up in a free society.
Okay, well, let me just read out. This is the crux of the poll that I was referring to. A month ago, the upcoming election was likely to be a status quo election, with May polling showing 49% of likely voters thought the country was in the right taking the right direction, and 39% thought the country was on the wrong track. The latest poll shows that 36% of the country is taking the right direction, while the wrong track response is now up to 56%. And you can say, well, some of that has just been the last couple of weeks of the bear market really seizing people and people fearing for their retirement funds and so on. But the interesting comment that Stan Greenberg makes is we've gone from a status quo election to an anti-incumbent election in a very short period of time. Nuri Teixeira, do you think that that's actually the case?
Yes, at least the way it looks right now. We'll have to see how it looks in November, but certainly compared to 6 weeks ago, this is now looking to be an extremely competitive election, if not leaning toward the Democrats. It's going to be volatile. A lot of people out there say they can't vote to reelect their congressman anymore. There is that sense of wanting to send somebody a message out there among the electorate, and I think the message they're likely to send is by and large going to be one that will disadvantage Republicans, particularly Republican incumbents.
Senator Corzine, in talking to your colleagues, do they feel this, that particularly the ones who are facing re-election, that suddenly there is an anti-incumbent feeling out there?
I certainly believe that people are focused on the need to act. Give you the most visible example is the prescription drug benefit, which we tried four different approaches this week, and believe me, it was sincere that over the last 2 weeks, actually. But it was a sincere attempt to try to find compromise. And there were Republicans and Democrats alike, particularly those that are up for election, that were searching for the right model that would bring together the 60 votes that we needed to get that passed. And I think we'll come back in September and do that, because I think people are looking for deliverables.
Because if you don't, that's a bipartisan attack ad in the making, isn't it? I mean, the
right.
Incumbent gets attacked. You couldn't pass that bill.
You've got it. And I think that will hurt both Republicans and Democrats. And I think all of us who are in the political process know that we have a responsibility to try to come up with a deliverable here. And almost everyone has run their elections around that opportunity to serve the seniors in America. And it's going to be a challenge for incumbents to say, why didn't that happen?
Rui Teixeira, do you want to add in on this?
No, I think Senator Corzine has fairly summed it up.
But you don't get a sense. You agree or disagree with Stan Greenberg about a sudden surge of anti-incumbent feeling?
Oh, I do. I mean, we need to flesh that out. What exactly is the content of that? What is likely to mean politically? But I think that simple statement is true based on the data I've seen.
Well,
I do, by the way, agree or think that on balance, first of all, there are more Republicans up for election than Democrats this time, which is the luck of the draw. But there is an element that I think that you can't walk away from the fact that I think the Democratic Party has the impression that people represent a greater sense of equality or fairness or a level playing field that I think will be easier for Democrats to say, we're working for you, Mr. and Mrs. Citizen, that everybody's getting an equal shot at the American promise, relative to those that represent corporate interests and those that have done well in society economically. I think there's this corporate issue that, some would say populist issue, I guess was debated at the DLC. I'm not a member, so I wasn't there. But the fact is that I think we need to make sure that Democrats voice the argument for fairness in this process. If we do, I think that cuts even more strongly for us in the population. And I think it can be a very powerful theme this fall.
Senator Corzine, stay with us. We'll be coming back to you after the break. Rui Teixeira, stay with us. We'll be coming back to you after the break. Is fairness a sufficient enough I don't know, battle call for a campaign. You're listening to On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the upcoming November election. It may seem a far way away in the middle of a nice summer evening, but it's not. People are already strategizing about it. We're talking about this with Rui Teixeir, and we're also talking about it with Democratic Senator John Corzine from New Jersey. And just before the break, Senator, you were talking about getting a message of we're a party of fairness out. And I'm just wondering, is that a sufficient message, do you think, particularly, you know, where local concerns are being voted on as they are when you're electing your local representative to Congress? Is fairness just going to be a sufficient battle cry?
Well, I think when you put it then in the practical context of does the CEO of a corporation have health insurance and 40 million Americans don't, or do those that have done well in society and had access to power, have these people, do they have pensions when 50% of the American people don't have pensions? When you put it into terms of whether we're cleaning up our Superfund sites or whether we're giving tax breaks to those that have earned their income off of polluting the land. I think there are ways to make that clear to the American people. If you want a serious prescription drug benefit, is it right that we're cutting the tax rates for those that have done the very best in America? The marginal top tax rates are repealing the estate tax so that we don't have the resources to provide this prescription drug benefit. Is that fair? I think a lot of Americans would say they're going to vote for the people that think we ought to have some balance, some progressivity in how our income tax system works, and they want these kinds of resources on education, health care, environment.
Senator Corzine, I want to thank you very much for taking time to join this conversation. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Take care.
Rui Teixeir, if you were strategizing right now with a single candidate in a tight race, would you think that fairness is going to be sufficient to get him over the hump if you were a Democratic candidate?
Well, lacking any real information about this hypothetical race, it'd be hard to say whether fairness as a theme was going to be sufficient by itself. I certainly think it would be something that a typical candidate is going to want to try to take advantage of, and it's going to want to emphasize. A lot of the things that Senator Corzine mentioned really are things that when the Democrats find themselves on the right side of public opinion, that people do have a sense that it isn't quite fair the way a lot of these things have been done. The budgetary priorities are wrong. The right things aren't being invested in. The people at the top are making too much, and the people at the very top, as they've just seen, are not only making too much, but they're actually taking advantage of the rules to enrich themselves beyond the wildest dreams of avarice, while sort of ordinary Americans find their retirement accounts suddenly depleted. So I think in that broad sense, it is a powerful theme. Whether in any given election it's all you need to talk about, I think, is something you'd be hard to say, lacking particulars.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Paul is on the line.
Hi. I'm very glad you had John Corzine on. He's a good guy. But look what he had to do to get elected in New Jersey. He had to spend tens of millions of dollars of his own money.
He had it.
Well, he had it. I think it's wonderful that he had it and then he chose to spend it. But if he was a guy with a lot less resources and the same ideals and objectives, he wouldn't have gone anywhere. And I think that's a dilemma for the Democratic Party. There is a basic difference, I think, between what Democrats and Republicans are appealing to. And as long as the Democrats have very much the same system for choosing their candidates as the Republicans, the difference in what they're appealing to is really not going to be expressed. And I think one of the things the Democratic Party should do is to make sure that its primaries, both local primaries for statewide office and and the Congress, as well as national office, offer people a real opportunity to get out and say what they really believe in. Because I do agree that I think that the central tenets of the Democratic Party are very appealing to most Americans. They just don't get expressed.
They don't get expressed by the candidates that ultimately win out the primary process. They don't get expressed in the way campaigns are conducted and the kind of, you know, message they're putting out. I'm not quite following you.
I think both things are exactly true. I mean, the last presidential campaign was Al Gore's to win, or I should say to lose, and he was successful in losing it. And somewhere along the way, he swallowed the notion that it was more important to be electable than to be expressive. So it may, at that level, be nothing more than strategy and listening to the wrong advisors, but it goes all the way down to the local level in Democratic politics, in that they're no better at the Republicans in giving people a forum and encouragement to express what really are their basic political values.
I like that alliteration, electable versus expressible. that basically you're saying you get somebody who's going to, I don't know, they focus group to death and they go out and say what the focus group says they should say,
yeah,
as
exactly
opposed
right.
to expressing themselves.
Yeah,
Paul, are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
I'm calling from Massachusetts, and I think you should keep an eye on the primary campaign for governor in Massachusetts, because there are a couple of people who have ideas. Robert Reich is one of them. And I'd be very interested to see how he's going to fare in the field of candidates, who some of whom also are have worthy ideas, but others of whom are, you know, nothing more than successful politicians. It might be a bellwether, I think, for the future of the Democratic Party, demographics aside.
Demographics aside, let me ask you, Reed, to comment on that.
Well, I guess I'd have to say, I think if we're looking at the future prospects of the Democrats in general, I think the demographic trends probably are somewhat more important than what happens in the Massachusetts gubernatorial primary. I mean, Massachusetts is quite a liberal state, and really not much is happening there that's really at the cutting edge, I think, of where the country is going. I mean, no disrespect to Robert Reich. I like him a lot. But the real serious changes have taken place in states like California. Corzine State of New Jersey is an excellent example of how trends have run against the Republicans in a given state, where, you know, you basically have a coalition emerging where you have professionals, elements of the white working class, and minorities and women, particularly single, highly educated and working women, kind of coming together in a demographic constellation that really makes it quite difficult for the Republicans to fare well. In fact, they get to the point where they're mostly fighting among themselves and stabbing each other in the back because the conservative base of the party thinks the problem is they're not being conservative enough. And then the more moderate ones want to run somebody who's electable, so they become more like the Democrats, which really annoys the conservatives even more. So you have this kind of meltdown. That's really the story of the Republican Party in the Northeast. It's somewhat the story of the Republican Party in California. It's the story that we're going to see for the Republican Party in some other places, too. I think these kinds of evolutionary changes are really doing important things to U.S. politics. And
but
while
I think,
I support the idea that people in Massachusetts are trying to think differently as they run in the gubernatorial primary, it's not really, I think, that indicative of where we're going politically.
Paul, Does that satisfy you, or do you want to put the question differently?
I think it misses the point.
Yeah.
First of all, to be in Massachusetts is to, and I've just moved back here, is to realize that it's far from a liberal state. And secondly, I don't think that it's a question of Massachusetts leading the way. I think it's a question of seeing whether, given the same sort of orientation toward use of media in Massachusetts as everywhere else in the country, whether it's going to be possible for a candidate to express ideas and to, I think, to resonate with ideals that I think a lot of the voting population really has. I just don't know whether it's possible.
I mean,
that's why I'd say that it's a bellwether.
I think leaving aside Massachusetts, I mean, to me, the point that you made that's interesting is there space, really, in this, I mean, Democratic majority that you see coming, for this kind of open expression? I mean, if it's going to be a majority, don't Democratic candidates really have a greater space to really express their own ideas rather than the messages that, you know, that their advisors tell them the public wants to hear?
I think there's some truth to that. I think as the contours of this emerging dominance become clearer, I think it actually does give candidates a few more degrees of freedom that they have now. When things are viewed as, you know, a party is viewed as teetering on the edge of just barely holding on to majority and having to be sort of, in a sense, a lot of what the Democrats did in the 90s under Clinton was realign themselves, sort of reposition themselves in terms of some image problems they had. And they were viewed as being out of the center on a lot of some important issues. And they were able to deal with that and, I think, change the image of the party quite a bit. Now they're maybe in a position where they can, in at least some states, maybe nationally, we'll see in the future, sort of be a little bolder in what they say and how they say it because they can take advantage of the fact things are going their way. I think the idea that things are going their way is still not quite clear to your typical Democratic politician, but I do believe that over the next few years it will become increasingly clear, and we may see, because of that, a willingness to be, as the caller is putting it, more expressive, more authentic, bolder about what they say and how they say it. I certainly believe there can be a relationship between those two things.
I'd like to bring into the conversation now Professor Larry Sabato. He's professor of government and foreign affairs at the University of Virginia. He joins us from Charlottesville. Good evening.
Good evening.
Now, you've been listening to that last interchange. Do you have any thoughts about when it might be possible for Democrats to again feel sufficiently comfortable that they can actually, you know, stand up and say what they really think as opposed to staying on message in the hope of just being elected?
Well, having just turned 50, I realize I don't have a crystal ball. I gave that up years ago. It's impossible to predict. I suppose I just did join the conversation about 5 minutes ago, just listening in, so I've missed a good bit of it. But what I've heard ignores several things that are important in American history. The first is that the most durable slogan in all of American history is it's time for a change. This produces new coalitions with regularity, new party dominance, but they're transient. Rarely do those coalitions last more than a few decades, and then they yield to something else. Also, I don't think either major party is going to move toward any kind of dominance in the new century, because you can't have realignment in an age of de-alignment. And since the 1970s, voters in droves have been de-aligning from the two major parties. They're not necessarily identifying with third parties, though I fully expect an independent to be elected president in the next century, reclaiming the crystal ball that I said was cracked. But I really do believe that. And so I'm always suspicious of theories that purport to suggest that one party or the other will become the dominant party. I just don't think that's possible anymore.
Oui?
I would disagree with that. I know there's a considerable debate, and certainly among academics, about the realignment literature. There are some people who do believe, and I guess Professor Sabato is one, that there really aren't going to be any more realignments, and there hasn't been one for a long time because of this tendency toward de-alignment. However, I do tend to believe that if you look at the political history of the last 30 years, the kind of thing that Kevin Phillips talked about in the emerging Republican majority did in many ways come to pass. There was a important change in the way U.S. politics was run, particularly at the presidential level. A new coalition did emerge and did have a period of dominance and really reshaped our politics. And I agree with Professor Sabato that these coalitions, when they do emerge, they won't last for 50 years. But even if they last just a few decades, that's important and will, you know, have a big effect on how people experience life in America and where we go from there.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Tim is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania.
Hello.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Maybe I should write a book, The Coming Green Revolution. Coming Green Majority.
We've been waiting on that Green Majority since 1968. I don't know.
Data may be slim on that one.
you never know. It seems to me that the Democratic Party all of a sudden has found its progressive side again after it totally trashed and ignored it and became neoliberals and semi-Republicans. This sentiment, anti-incumbent sentiment, is going to run pretty deep because the problems that we're facing now, these corporate excesses and so on have been in large part because of the Democrats. Without their vote and without their acquiescence, these things wouldn't have happened. And Lieberman was a big friend of Enron, and it goes on and on. I mean, without as long as there's this corporate, like the fellow Paul earlier, as long as they're picking candidates and they're running elections with corporate money, the way they are, and corporations have the first step in the door of the congressman's office. Things aren't going to particularly change. I think the public is getting wind of it now.
Tim, that's a comment. Do you have a question for?
I guess my question is what is your author's connections with the Democratic Party?
Okay, that's a fair question.
And the other thing is their newfound progressive. They think they can revive their progressive side when the progressive side left with the Green Party.
Let's just ask everybody to declare an interest. Do you work with Democratic candidates?
Oh, I do not.
You don't?
I do not. I mean, I work at a think tank called the Century Foundation, and one of the main things I do is research and write about politics, and this is the fruit of some of those analyses. I mean, I personally vote Democratic, but, I don't. Okay. Not in the political consulting business.
Right. And Larry?
I'm a pure independent. Okay. I grew up in the Democratic Party, worked in Democratic campaigns. I've totally cut all ties to all parties, and I'm perfectly happy that way.
But, I mean, Tim, of course, brings up an interesting point, because the key dynamic in 2000 was that sufficient group of de-aligned, probably former Democrats, who chose to vote for Ralph Nader and thus enabled George Bush to become president. Is that likely to continue to be a factor, do you think? That particular group of de-aligned people. Either one of you.
Oh, well, I'll jump in, I guess. I'm sure Larry has an opinion. I don't think so. I think that the Nader phenomenon is going to be fairly short-lived. I think it brought people up a little, gave them a lot of pause when they woke up. It wasn't just the day after Election Day. It took a while to be resolved. But in the end, it was clear that Nader's presence had quite an impact in the election and helped to elect George W. Bush. I don't think that's what those people had in mind. So I think there's going to be a lot of regrets about that, and I think it's going to be very hard for the Greens to run a credible
campaign. Rui, I've got to interrupt you now. We're coming to the break. Rui, stay with us. Professor Sabatou, stay with us. I'm Michael Goldfarb. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking with Rui Teixeira of the Century Foundation, co-author of the forthcoming book, The Emerging Democratic Majority, and Professor Larry Sabatou, who is a professor of government and foreign affairs at the University of Virginia. And we're talking about the Democratic Party. We're talking about it and its prospects for regaining both houses of Congress in November and looking a little bit further into the future. The possibility of consolidating the gains it's steadily been making since 1994 and perhaps becoming a dominant majority for some time. Rui Teixeira, we had a call on this program a couple of weeks ago from someone in Wisconsin who was saying, when are the Democrats just going to fight? I think he was referring to the fact that much of the media out in America is, pretty belligerent. It's very, very dominated by Republican right-wing commentary. I mean, when I say media, I'm not talking about people who read the New York Times and listen to NPR. I'm talking about what's out there in general, where there's a tremendous amount of right-wing talk radio. And I'm just wondering, is it actually a worthwhile thing for the rhetoric in the Democratic Party to be a bit more self-confident. I won't say belligerent. Let's just say self-confident and assertive in talking about their issues.
I guess I'd say on balance, that's probably true. I think that if you look at the way the country is trending, as I've been talking about, if you look at the issues that the Democrats tend to want to bring up, and this is most of your basic domestic policy agenda, their views are by and large substantially more popular than the Republicans. The Republicans are sort of out of gas on most of these issues. They did their tax cut thing. It's had a lot of unintended consequences that are bad and that I think is pretty easy to bring to the attention of voters. I think they should have a certain amount of confidence if they press their case vigorously, they will, over the medium term, win. So it's hard to say on a very specific basis what should candidate A say in race B exactly in that way. I don't know. That's all local. But I think by and large, the Democrats could afford to be somewhat more aggressive than they're being. I mean, they've got I think they've got the wind in their sails. So why not?
Larry Salvatore, do you agree with that?
Well, partly. Look, it depends on where the campaign's being run. If you've got a campaign in the Northeast or the industrial states of the Midwest, some of them, or the West Coast, yes, the Democrats can be more strident or more pumped up about their issues. If the campaign's being run in the South or the border states or the Rocky Mountain states and they want to be elected, forget it. That gets back to the basic gulfs that exist in the country, not so much on economic issues, but on cultural issues. And also, just to refer to the other point, well made though it was, coalitions exhaust themselves. I mean, that's the whole history of American politics. Yes, I agree that since 94, the Republicans have basically been in charge. Clinton had essentially the veto power, and that was about it. And the Republicans enacted most of their agenda, and they have exhausted their store of ideas. And that will inevitably lead to some period of greater Democratic emphasis, if not control. But then Democrats will get into power and do the very same thing. They'll exhaust their agenda. Let's not forget that in June of 1992, Ross Perot was at 40% in the Gallup poll. Bush the senior was at 28% and Clinton was at 26%. If Perot had been sane, he would have been president. In 2000, the Green Party was mentioned. Let's not forget that in Florida, Nader got 50,000 votes, with the margin, officially determined by the courts, being 537 votes in Bush's direction. In New Hampshire, it was 22,000 votes for Nader, a 7,000-vote margin for Bush. Had Nader not been on the ballot, clearly Gore would have carried one or both of those states, probably both, and would have won the presidency easily. The point simply is that with floating coalitions, with the major parties no longer alone in the political calculus, there is no clear future. You can't define one party as becoming the dominant party for even a period of a few decades. I would call it more a period of 6 or 8 or 10 years, and that's about it. And that's not much of a prediction.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mike is calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Great. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm interested in your opinion on, you are talking about the Democrats campaigning on a message of fairness, and I'm interested in your opinion on why the Republicans wouldn't use the same message. It's not like they would be against the executive abuses or the corporate excesses or the falling stock market. I think, again, they could use the same platform, and I'm just interested a little bit more from the Republican side, because it seems to be somewhat slanted tonight towards the Democratic viewpoint, and I'm interested in your guest's opinion on that. Thanks.
Rita Shera.
Well, I mean, I do think the Republicans will try to run on some sort of reasonable facsimile of a lot of the Democratic issues. I mean, that's been characteristic of how they've run on issues like, for example, education and health care in the last few years, how Bush tried to run in 2000, how, even John Ashcroft in Missouri ran on, I'm a opponent of the drug companies. I'm going to make sure they, don't abuse good, honest, working people. So there's been a lot of that kind of attempt on the part of the Republicans to co-opt Democratic themes and essentially say Me Too, but a little bit different. And I think they'll do that on the corporate fairness and accountability issue as well. I mean, Bush is going to sign the bill, and, you know, they're going to try to get as much benefit from that as they can. Will they be successful? I think it's better than, you know, sort of putting their heads in the sand. It's not clear to me that it's going to be enough to fool voters into thinking there's really no difference between the parties. I think the Republicans are identified so clearly and so closely, particularly in terms of this corporate issue, with one particular side, that I think they're going to have a hard time maintaining that they're really just the same as the Democrats. We've always been, you know, opposed to corporate abuses, and we just want to put all these people in jail and be done with it. I think their record is a little bit too long, a little bit too clear for them to be able to get away with that. But I think they'll try.
We've got time for one last quick call. Miriam is on the line.
Well, I'll try to make this quick. I agree with the person who phoned in a few weeks ago who said, why don't the Democrats fight? I think that the Democrats have lost their vision and their fire. I think that the coming campaign, if it's run on corporate malfeasance, and we're going to correct it a little bit, I, as a lifelong Democrat, have absolutely no interest. I want to see the Democrats stand up and scream about what is happening to civil rights, what's happened to welfare mothers, about an education plan that has no funding, about the states, like the state of Massachusetts, where I'm in, strangling and not being able even to take care of its Medicaid patients. People are not stupid. We see what's happening. But the Democrats have to get up and say it. My idea of a campaign would be to say, by their deeds shall you know them. Here are two columns. One side, compassionate conservative. Other side, Democrat. And list six pieces of legislation of the Republicans and that the Democrats fought for or against. Let us see what these parties stand for. That's my idea.
Have you considered a career as a political consultant? Miriam.
I'm too old.
You're never too old. Come on. Thank you for sharing that with us, Miriam. There is this thing out there, gentlemen, and we are coming to the end of the hour, and I just may be repeating myself, but there does seem to be a real desire, grassroots people, for a bit of passion and fight from the Democratic Party. Is it going to work? There have been other times in recent history where that kind of passion has driven people away. Do you think if the time is now right for passion to draw people back to the party? Anyone can answer this.
Well, I'll just toss something in. There'll be passion when the circumstances of an election year conspire to produce a likely victory for the Democrats, just as the same would be true for Republicans. That's when passion tends to come into politics these days.
Professor Sabato, thank you very much. Larry Sabato, professor of government and foreign affairs at the University of Virginia. He was with us from Charlottesville in Virginia. And Rita Scherer, thank you very much for being with us this whole hour, author of the forthcoming book, The Emerging Democratic Majority. Continue the conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, business booms for a security consultant. This is On Point. Paul Smith is a partner with a business consulting firm in Boston. Before September 11th, his job was to help businesses run more efficiently. Now Smith finds himself in hot demand as a security expert. In this radio diary, Smith describes how the focus of his job has changed and how the September 11th attacks allowed him to utilize a long-neglected expertise.
For many years, I worked with the Department of Defense, where we would look at our military equipment and we would look at how a terrorist would kill or would destroy that equipment, and we would put in countermeasures to make sure that we could reduce that. Then later on in my life, I switched over to nuclear power. And nuclear power, hey, we had something that, if destroyed, would have an impact on America or the world for up to 25,000 years. We couldn't afford that type of accident. Now I'm using that same experience post 9/11 to look at a system to find its vulnerability and think like a terrorist. I'm taking knowledge that only to very recently was even considered very important and bringing it back. Just recently, I went to a strategic planning of a major hospital in our area. They talked about what they were going to do for the next 10 years. And I looked at their plan, and I didn't see much in the area of security. It hasn't got down to the point where people really start to spend money on it yet. For example, I'll talk to people, and I'll say, your air intake is on ground level. And I'll say to them, you're vulnerable. And they say, well, what do you expect me to do about that? I say, I would expect you to fix it. And they say, well, where am I going to get the money? So that's the big challenge right now. The challenge I see right now is that I don't see people putting it in their budget. So it's more of a sales force right now. You still, even post 9/11, you got to sell people on what they really have to do. In my job, we really have to think like a terrorist, because the only way we can protect ourselves is to think about what a terrorist would do. I'm thoroughly amazed when I see all these buildings now, and everyone is, you know, looking at you as you walk in the building. And all of a sudden, people who've been in this building for the last 3 years, never been questioned, now they're standing in line showing their ID going into their own building. But a terrorist doesn't think that way. A terrorist will look at you as 360. Terrorists will look at where are you vulnerable. They'll look at the place so they can penetrate, get in, and get out and not be seen. I would call the security we're doing now on stopping the little old ladies or the businessmen is what we call feeling good security. It really does not make me feel one penny or one bit safer. When I was working for the Department of Defense, all my discussions and thoughts were what we're going to be doing in other countries. It never occurred to me that we would be looking at our own country and doing work for us, at us. And it gives it a total different framework. You can be much more academic when it's not your house, your family, your relatives. But when it becomes you, I think you get much more intense. And you get, I think you give it much more energy than you would have given it if it was not protecting your own homeland. But once it becomes me or my family or someone I know, it's more than academic, it's emotional. Right now, in our consulting field, it's a consultant's dream. Everyone wants you. Phone's off the hook. I say I want to give a course or a discussion on vulnerability, and the room is full. It's really unfortunate that it's a consulting dream. At the same time, you see all the hurt. It's a tragedy for everyone. I also feel that from a business point of view, you know that the money you put in security is a non-value add. It doesn't make you more productive. So I'm a little afraid that it's making the country less productive, and therefore it's making the world less productive. So we're putting things, you know, if you've learned in economics, you either can spend money on butter or guns. And right now we're spending money on the guns. We should be spending money on the butter. I'm concerned that because of what happened, we were putting the focus on something that we didn't want to focus on and we shouldn't be focusing on. I don't think that we should be focusing on security, but as a consultant, you go after whatever the public needs.
Paul Smith is a partner with the Peak Leadership Group. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.